Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Guide podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and today is a big day for us here at FX Guide. I've got Mike Seymour on the line with me.
Yeah, we've got a really great interview with the guys from the Da Vinci Code, or at least the team at Double Negative that worked on it. But before that, we thought we'd have a chat together about what's been happening this week for us, because it's been a huge week.
Yeah, it has been. And today, for those of you who don't know, is actually our first official day of classes, which is quite exciting. And in the fxphd.com website, our online training venture, class rolls out today on Monday with Background Fundamentals, which is a class that you're leading up, Mike.
Yeah, we're looking at how to do time splice. So we've got a time splice shoot. We're going to go through all the tips and tricks of what you need to think about when looking at one of those. And then, in fact, we're going to take that footage and build it up, because we also did an HDR on site there. So we'll do that in upcoming episodes. We're going to look at it in terms of optical flow. So while we're going to work up a shot, mostly we're going to be obviously looking at the theory behind those different aspects. And it should be a lot of fun, actually. A lot of fun doing the shoot. I still have the bruises to prove it.
Yeah, great scenes.
Took
of
one
you
for the team.
Great scenes of you falling on the floor multiple times.
Yeah, next time we hire a stuntman. But it's been huge, hasn't it?
It's
amazing
been great.
Response.
It has been great. The response has been wonderful, and it's really rewarding, really nice to hear that from all of our students who've signed up for the site. And Background Fundamentals is just one of the courses. You know, we're rolling out a 3ds Max class, a Toxic class, After Effects, Shake, and Final Cut Pro, and one on Flame Expressions even.
And not only have we had a really great response from students, but we've had really great response from our friends at other key websites around the place. The guys like Will over at high-end3d.com and Alex at PixelCore, and just a whole bunch of people we've been talking to and wishing us luck. And we're certainly aiming to be as collaborative as possible moving forward and working with as many other key people around the web as we can.
Yeah, that's true, and even support from manufacturers. I mean, the Toxic class that I'm doing, feel really fortunate that Autodesk has just been absolutely wonderful, and hopefully we're going to have really some great things to announce in the future.
This is the bit where I have to bite my tongue, but I'm going to skid the lines of legality by saying that actually we have amazing news coming up with Autodesk, who obviously cover a range of key products and in the 2D and 3D space, and also really great news coming up with Apple. We've been working with Apple's core training group, and so in the next weeks, not defined, don't hold me to it, we're going to be announcing some huge things with those equipment manufacturers, and that'll be great. And
we're chomping at the bit. The cogs of the machinery sometimes run a bit slower, I guess, than we do, which is understandable, but it's really going to be some great stuff, I think.
Well, we have Shake available on VPN, which means if you wanted to learn the Shake course, you can download a full copy of Shake and then run it and learn with it. With Max, we're recommending people get the 30-day eval license, but we're working on some clever things with Max, but certainly the 30-day eval license will get people going for Max. And then there are other cool things in the works for some of the other apps. We hope to have them really soon, but it's one of those chicken and egg problems, isn't it, John? It's like everyone says, well, once you've got the site up and running, we'll happily sign a deal. And we're like, well, we kind of want to get it up and running with you signed. And they're like, okay, well, give me 2 weeks. And I'm like, yeah, I don't have 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. But no, it is going to be great too. And hey, actually some other stuff related to the courses too that's coming up, some great stuff with the Final Cut Pro that you've been working on with Professor Nick.
Oh yeah, so one of the things we thought we'd do with the, because we're really keen to get people to be able to develop stuff and have their own copies. I think one of the things that you miss out on sometimes when you're doing DVDs as a way of learning is that you don't actually necessarily get any shots you can call your own. And so we're solving that in a number of the courses. Like in the Shake course, even though it's a 101 course, we're going to develop up a really cool shot with an angel, and it'll be really fun, and people can customize that. And then we're sitting around in the Final Cut course, and we're like, you know, we're going to develop something fun to do in the Final Cut course because, you know, this is the entertainment industry, and we want to have some fun with it. And we struck on a really cool idea, which was Machinima. So we're going to actually do a, in the kind of background, I guess, of the FCP course, a entire Machinima thing. So there's a, I think the jury's out, I think it's going to be Halo based, but it might be Star Wars, the Lego edition based. But, we're going to have footage that people can download and edit. And of course, the trick of doing this is that if you have, say, Halo yourself, you can generate additional scenes and additional material. And then by the end of the term, we're going to have everybody cutting up their you know, movies about using those characters. So if you're not across Machinima, what happens is you take the footage and then you revoice the characters yourself and then edit up. And so while obviously an obvious way to go would be some kind of action thing, they get really funky when people cut up things like Halo into kind of, I don't know, vegetarian cooking courses or something, and you get the characters to do something that we'd totally not expect. Though, to be really careful, because you occasionally shoot somebody or blow somebody up. It takes about half an hour for the scorch marks to disappear for continuity, so to be careful about that. But you're a bit of a Halo fan, aren't you, John?
Yeah, I am, and it's really great. Just do a search on the web for some of that stuff and see what Mike's talking about, if you haven't heard of it before. But I think that's going to be a great aspect of that Final Cut class.
And I think we spoke to the guys at Red versus Blue, who's one of the leading exponents of this, and we'll be posting that interview on the FXPhD site. And then you know, that's a really good case. Those guys are very funny, so that'll be fun. And yeah, we're doing all sorts of interesting things right across the board. So, and we're doing interesting things here on FX Guide as well. For example, one of the emails we got recently was a question, you know, how does ILM work with their internal stuff? And they asked particularly about Saber and Xeno. And as you know, we covered that with the Poseidon adventure in terms of the proprietary Xeno stuff. But we actually went and tracked down some guys and really drilled down on how Saber works at ILM. So that's going to be coming up on FX Guide real soon, as will a bunch of other stuff. We've got lots of good stuff coming on FX Guide, so that should be fun. And, you know, it would be remiss of me if I didn't wish you happy birthday today as well, John.
Oh, why, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for sneaking that in as well. Very, very important birthday for me. So, changing the subject, let's get to another feature from actually a current release, which is the DaVinci Code and the subject of our podcast this week, the interview you did. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that before we dive into the interview?
Yeah, the really interesting thing about the DaVinci Code is that, I mean, the film has obviously comes with an enormous amount of interest because of the fact that the book was so huge. And yet, obviously, there are certain things that are easier done in a book than done any other way, especially when you're trying to explain complex codes being cracked and stuff. So I guess a bunch of the stuff that I found of interest in talking to the guys at Double Negative was both how they resolved the aesthetic issues of kind of visualizations of solutions, and then discovering some of the stuff they did that you had no idea about. And one of the cathedrals, John, that is prominently featured in the film is completely under scaffold in real life. And so you've got all these shots that look completely normal. And of course, they just couldn't shoot them because, well, they could go to the cathedral and they had rights to be there and everything was fine. You know, cathedral under a mesh doesn't shoot that well.
Sounds like my recent trips to Europe where I go and visit some of the famous cathedrals and they're all covered with scaffolding and plastic. Well, I think that's about enough for our introduction today. Let's go ahead and join your interview recorded last week.
Well, if ever there was a film that the book was going to help the opening weekend of, it would have to be The Da Vinci Code. Steve, you're joining us on the line from London. Huge film.
Hello there. Yes, no, it was a very big film. I mean, it has to be said that I've worked on quite a few big films now, and just walking around at Shepperton, it was a vast project, just in terms of everything. It was a very, very big project, so it was a good one to work on.
And Ron Howard, probably one of the best directors of our generation. I mean, just superb body of work, and from all accounts, an incredibly positive creative force. Was that how you found working on the film?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it was a very... I mean, he had a very tight-knit crew of people that he works with, and you can just tell there was a real sense of energy, and you know, it was just interesting to see that, even though it was a vast-scale, huge-scale film, there was quite an intimacy in kind of the main people. They knew exactly what they were doing, and yeah, I mean, it was actually a very good project to work on in terms of you know, speed and
Yeah. Now, you've worked on a lot of films, and I'll just touch on a couple. Mission Impossible 2, Doom, Lara Croft.
Yep.
And all good films, but this one really had to, in many cases, have a lot of invisible visual effects as opposed to some of those more obvious effects films.
Very much. I mean, the whole brief from Ron and from Angus Bickerton, the visual effect, film's visual effects supervisor, was, you know, no one wanted to see the visual effects. I mean, for example, we have a shot with Silas driving, which is a very effectsy shot, very similar to the one in... War of the Worlds, where, you know, the camera is very, very, a lot simpler. But at the same time, they didn't want the shot to stand out as a, you know, it had to be a moment of magic rather than, oh, look at that visual effect shot. And obviously that went through to the whole gamut of work we did, be it replacing stuff on, you know, Chapel, on Roslyn Chapel to Castle Gandolfo. So it was very much a brief to be photoreal and subtle, really.
So I'll come back to the subtle visual effects in a minute. One of the things I wanted to really ask you about is that the issue of sort of design and production design, and especially in the visualizations of things to do with the code, how did you guys approach that?
I mean, basically what we did is we started work on the film very early in terms of doing some pre-visualization. We did lots of looks. I mean, the main showy, not showy, but the main kind of representation of the visualizations of, like, for example, what Robert Langdon, Tom Hanks' character, would see in his mind. We did two sequences. There was the Fibonacci sequence, and then there was the Newton's tomb sequence. So we started off with a team of pre-visors, and obviously lots of designs, and it very quickly became apparent, you know, where we were going with that, with those sequences.
How much did you get influenced by the fact that, while the film is set in the modern day, of course it stretches back to Leonardo da Vinci's period? Did that affect any of the 3D or the design?
I think, you know, there was, especially Newton's tomb sequence, there was obviously, you know, it was a part of it, but I don't think it was the driving force, especially on those two sequences. It was much more a kind of way of showing representations, but in a less showy way, as it were.
So let's just get some of the parameters of the team. How big was the team? How long were you on the project for?
I started in August last year, and we finished at the about 4 weeks ago, actually. I had a crew. It wasn't a huge team. We had quite a long time. It's one of those projects where we were able to have a smaller team running for a longer time. So I'd say at its peak, we probably had about 30 people.
And what were the main areas that the team focused on in terms of shot counts? I mean, was it because there was
We did about 140 shots in the whole film. I'd say we did, Newton's tomb was 12 shots, and then there was lots of individual moments. We had, of course, the obligatory, with the planes flying, we had lots of window composites. There was about 50 of those, just looking out of windows and putting, obviously, skies and stuff like that in. But there was a hardcore, I would say, about 50 shots that, you know, were the ones we spent most of the time on.
And I believe that Jasper's there now. Maybe we can have a chat to him about some of those CG plans.
Yeah, Jasper. Hold on. There you go. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. We're just starting to discuss the work that your team did with, especially the 3D plane and stuff, the full reconstruction stuff.
Okay.
Could you walk us through how you approached those shots?
Well, actually, a lot of the 3D was quite easy to divide up into, like, the plane or my sarcophagus shot or other things like that. So we had, for all the planes, was essentially one person doing it because we had quite a long time. You know, with a little bit of help, but essentially looking over all of those shots and doing most of the work themselves. There's nothing... you know, like the planes, there's nothing, or actually, I think overall, there's anything out of the ordinary. It's just off-the-shelf tools. Most of them are in all the tools that were built up through the years of Double Negative are, you know, all of that was being used. There was nothing really written or anything extra done for them. So and I think for Angus was kind of very keen on using a lot of getting us to make a lot of real kind of flares and things like that, rematching artifacts that happens in cameras and things like that. So that was a kind of a big deal when it kind of came to the compositing as well.
So did you say that just one person worked on the planes and stuff? How long were they on that for?
Oh, they were on from the very beginning until we delivered.
Really? So so the team, in terms of the split between 3D and 2D, was it more of a 2D compositing exercise, or was there things like Newton's Tomb and the 3D visualization stuff, did they take time to develop?
Well, it went a little bit up and down. I mean, when we did the previous thing in the beginning, we had a fair few people. You know, for the that then as the project developed, we had kind of ended up with persons taking care of different parts, like the plane and the Mare Sarcophagus, and someone taking care of Newton's tomb. But there's always a few other people. I mean, you always have some match movers and some people helping out modelling, etc. So.
You mentioned the previs there. I was just curious what sort of previs you were doing. Is it the sort of previs that just tries to get the beats down, or was it previs that was actually working out, you know, we need to have this lens at this angle, at this height off the deck kind of thing?
It was all of that. We were prevising full sequences, not only visual effects shots. It was kind of complete sequences and, you know, trying different angles and everything that Angus would then use as almost as a moving storyboard, really, as a guide to what they were to shoot.
Was Ron and the production team based in America at that stage, or they moved to London for the during the previous?
Yeah, the visual effects team was they were always here. So, you know, the production was the production moved after the shoot back to America, but the visual effects team were always based here. It's a few blocks up from here, so it's very accessible. We could just walk over to them, have a look at things in the visual effects editorial, and they could always walk back here and pop in whenever they could, whatever they wanted. So it's a lot easier to work that way than when you have the visual effects based in America.
True. So I could have a chat to Victor about the 2D. That'd be great.
Yeah. Okay. Here he comes.
Hi. So I hear that you guys had a really easy job because nothing was under scaffold and everything was really easy. Is that true?
That's not quite the case, no.
Tell us about the situation with the chapel.
Well, Roslyn Chapel, I think, has had a fair amount of money to improve itself, and as a result of that, it's been put under scaffold. So obviously it's one of the locations for some of the shots in the film that needed to be recreated in a number of ways. The production did build a miniature of the chapel for some shots, and we also produced a matte painting of that and a CG model as well to put into one of the shots towards the end of the film.
What resolution were you working at with the matte painting and stuff? In fact, was this all ended up 2K, or was there anything higher than that?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it was all worked on at 2K, so we got all the detail we needed out of that.
And so in the more stylistic scenes, the scenes that involved some of the more conceptual aspects of the storyline, how much did 2D have to look at it in terms of a design solution?
There was a fair amount. One of the interesting things about the job was the way the director of photography shot most of the film. He tended to shoot wide open, using as much natural light as he could, and obviously that gave everything quite a distinctive look, and we had to nail that in the visual effects shots to stop them from standing out, which goes along with the whole ethos of the project, which was to keep the visual effects unapparent that they're actually visual effects shots. So we had to match the shallow depth of field. The grain on a lot of the shots was quite noticeable because it was fast stock they were using, and as Jesper was saying, there was a lot of flaring in the lenses, that kind of thing.
So what was most of the compositing done on? What platform?
We comped everything in Shake, and it, that gave us all the tools we needed to make everything look look good. We used several of the tools that had been written at Double Negative before for positioning matte paintings and backgrounds in a 3D camera space, where the cameras have been tracked, or if we'd pre-vised the shots and created the camera move ourselves, that gave us the ability to put the backgrounds in the appropriate position for those shots as well.
So one of the spectacular shots is the end plummet into the Louvre, and can you talk to us about that shot, how it was put together, and how much you were bouncing stuff backwards and forwards between the other departments?
Yeah, there was a lot of back and forth with the, between 2D and 3D, and we were all sat quite close together, which made things a lot easier, obviously. A lot of the 3D guys were really good all-rounders. They were quite capable of doing lots of different things. So, you know, they'd send us passes over that they'd rendered. We'd look at them, comp them up, make suggestions, and it would bounce back to them, and they could implement that. For the shot of the Louvre Pyramid, we had a plate which had been shot for real with the Langdon character looking down into the pyramid. That essentially got completely replaced when we built the interior of the pyramid in 3D, and it was just Robert Langdon essentially was rotoed out and put back onto that. And then obviously the camera continues through the glass, right down through the inverted pyramid and down to Mary's sarcophagus, which was motion control elements that were all put together. So it was a big shot.
So there was models at the end of that, is that right? Or
the was just at the set end of the pieces. Shot, Mary's sarcophagus was motion control elements of a practical sarcophagus. And that was put into the kind of tomb around it and all lit. And we obviously use reference stills for the walls and that kind of thing.
Were you just doing 3D tracking to extend that motion control up, or did you actually get the data off the motion control stuff?
It went both ways with that shot. The camera move was visualized, and obviously the motion control was shot. Then after that happened, the camera move did evolve a little bit as the shot moved on. So there was a lot of little changes being made to make that shot work quite nicely.
And you mentioned before that Robert had to be rotoed, or his character was rotoed out at the beginning of the shot. Are you using? Yeah. Am I right in thinking you're using Silhouette for the roto as a plug-in to Shake, or are you? What's the procedure there?
Basically, we've had a roto tool written in-house at Double Negative that's very quick and responsive, and it allows us to roto stuff nice and quickly and get lots of feedback by scrubbing through the sequence, and that just imports directly into Shake, so it's very easy to transfer roto between the roto artist and the compositors.
So as you were finaling shots, were there any considerations for DI or any considerations for grading that came up? How was that handled?
Yeah, there was some of that. When we had our scans in, they were often a little bit out of sync in terms of the colour with each other. So what we did is we applied a basic neutral grade to them so that they all sat together quite nicely. And then we did deliver our shots with a neutral grade, and we didn't apply any grade that was given to us in the DI. But obviously we had to be sympathetic if Angus said to us that a shot was going to be potentially printed down to make it a bit darker or lifted up, then we had to bear that in mind when we were working so that the shot would hang together under those under that grading.
So were you finaling shots as digital projections, or were you doing film outs, or how was the actual process to final the shots?
We did do film outs. We watched a lot of stuff on the Baselite, which is a 2K playback system, and we've got a projector hooked up to that. So we watched it either on the monitor or on the projector. And then as we got further into the show, we started watching film outs projected. And surprisingly, it was pretty close to the 2K projection, actually. The 2K projection held up pretty well in that comparison, so that was reassuring for us.
Yeah. If you're using the Baselite, were you using TrueLight for your monitor calibration, or did you have your own setup for calibration?
I'm not sure, actually, on that show. I think we have our own monitor calibration setups.
It's great if the digital projection is standing up so well to the final projection, as you were saying, because
I was a little bit surprised, but I was pleased by that, because obviously it means we can view our shots very easily, make sure everything's going to look right, and obviously it gives us more confidence that what we're going to see is the same as what's going to get projected.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you could just put Steve back on again, and thank you for your time.
Sure, all right, thanks a lot. Okay.
Hello.
All right, well, thank you very much for getting the team to have a chat to us today, Steve.
That's not a problem at all.
I believe you're running into a new sort of horror flick. I don't know if we can ask you about that or not, but you're probably almost immediately onto the next project, are you?
Yes, what are you talking about, The Reaping?
Yeah, with Hilary Swank. None whatsoever. Well, we really appreciate you and the guys talking to us today. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure.
Wow, that was a really fascinating interview, Mike. I personally haven't seen the movie yet. Just obviously open this weekend. I've been busy this weekend, but I'm really looking forward to checking out that end scene, because the type of work that went into it just sounds incredible.
Well, you're busy because it was your birthday.
Yes, true.
Hey, I got a tip for you. If you want to see movies early, fly to Sydney, because movies start on a Thursday here, and because of the time zone, our Thursday is your Wednesday, so we nearly always see movies about 24 hours ahead of the rest of the world. So there's a tip for you.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Something we missed on talking about PhD, I think, is that you don't actually have to, like enrollments don't close at the beginning of term, do they?
No, they don't. You can join essentially any time up to close to the end of the term. But you can join and have full access to all the previous movies, all the previous class materials, all the previous forum messages, all that stuff. So let's say you join in week 5 or 6 or 7. You have a full 7 weeks' worth of downloads at your disposal on your account page that you can get up to speed on.
So that's really good, because nobody then misses out if they're a couple of weeks late or had holidays or whatever.
No, that's especially true. And then a lot of the reason we did that, too, is if you were gone for a couple of weeks or working on a big job and couldn't take the time to download, if you missed the initial distribution, you still download it any time during the term. So.
And on FX Guide, I just want to point out how much we've been enjoying the forums. The forums have been hot on FX Guide, and we love reading the stuff in the forums. So if you're interested in posting, I think there's a really low signal-to-noise ratio in the FX Guide, and for that matter, PhD forums. You know, there's not I've yet to see any PC versus Mac war type stuff or crap. So it's a great resource. So if you get a chance, check them out.
Yeah, definitely do that. I think that there's been a lot of great discussions lately, and also there, we have had some comments, and we're definitely going to be upgrading that forum software too this summer, so that we'll have even more functionality and have them be a little better experience too for people.
Yeah, I mean, I find it's really helpful on the FX Guide homepage. It has the last 5 kind of posts that have happened in the top corner of the homepage. And over in PhD, I find it's great just to press the new posts button in the middle of the forum page. I guess that's how I work with them, and I find them really easy that way. So I guess they are fairly large these days. We have a lot of people that are contributing, and a lot of very high-quality people as well. So it's been very rewarding for us to see that take off.
Yeah, that we appreciate people taking the time to post, because it's been very useful. Lots of good information exchanged there. Well, I think that's about it for this week. Thanks for listening.
I'll let you get off to your birthday dinner.
I am going to get off to my birthday dinner, crack open a bottle of wine, have a nice steak dinner, and enjoy the evening.
Okay, well, as it's first thing in the morning here, I'm going to get a good day's work in.
I'm going to go to the pub. All right, thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.